T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly. Sponsored by Insperity. HR that makes a difference. On News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Happy Friday, St. Louis. What a beautiful day it is out there. Hancock and Kelly are going to take you all the way to 10 o'clock, where we will then join the show. You know, the show with Chris Ranji and... what's her name?
Well, Kevin Wheeler's in that show.
Yeah, Kevin Wheeler's in that show. Oh, there you go. Amy Marks. I think that's it. Well, anyway, we'll join them today, and then we'll also be here later with the Glover Show. Good morning, John Hancock.
Top of the morning, big boy.
What a beautiful day, huh? Did you have the windows down on the way in?
For a little bit.
Yeah, it was nice, wasn't it?
Very nice.
Buddy, things are looking up for my side of the aisle. I was looking at some polling yesterday that Marco Rubio is now in a dead heat with Val Demings for the Senate. That would be a loss for the Republicans. You couple that with what we're looking at in Pennsylvania, with Dr. Oz.
Yeah.
As well as, what's the other race that we...
Georgia
that we've got in a great place against Herschel Walker. What should have been a red tidal wave may be just a red ripple to the House.
Well, you're a little overly optimistic there, my friend. But I do think the Democrats have had a good little run here for the last couple of weeks. But we're still 3 months before the election, and we'll see what happens with the inflation rate. If it does come down, that will be a plus for Democrats. But you know. The Senate, I think you're right. I think the path for a Republican majority in the Senate is going to be very tenuous, because Pennsylvania will be a loss to the Democrats. Ron Johnson's numbers in Wisconsin are not good. That would be a loss and a Democrat pickup. Now they're +2. And Mark Kelly in Arizona, Democrat senator, looks like his numbers are in pretty good shape. So that was a seat that Republicans could have picked up. I don't think Marco Rubio is going to lose Florida. You know, if Marco Rubio loses Florida, then it will be a really bad night.
Well, we will mark the tape on that one, because if you watch the trajectory of the race, John, it's changed quite drastically. It was a 10-point lead by Marco Rubio. Now it's virtually a dead heat. We still have about 2.5 months left of this slide to November. We can't forget that Liz Cheney faces her test on Tuesday of next week out in Wyoming.
Yeah, she's going to lose.
That's a shame.
And, well, yeah.
True conservative.
Yeah. No, she is a true conservative. There's no question about that. And she's going to lose. And I think she's known for some time that she's going to lose. And I don't think she particularly cares at this point. Yeah. You know, she was #3 in House leadership, got stripped of that, and is serving. You know, this January 6th committee is going to go away once the elections come. So, you know, I don't know that she particularly would want to go back and be a backbencher, even in a Republican majority.
It's Missouri, the Senate race, we haven't spoken about it yet, but, you know, conventional wisdom would say that this favors the Republicans. Obviously, this is a state went to Donald Trump by 20 points. We do have a very strong candidate on the Democratic side in terms of resources and ability to communicate to the voters, coupled with a lot of issues voting our way. Then there's going to be a unique thing on the ballot in Missouri, which is legalization of marijuana. In the past, I would have said that would have been probably leans more left, but a lot of the polling I've seen that shows that most Republicans and Democrats kind of all agree that let's just move on from this.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not for it, but I suspect that it will pass. You know, and really, the way the medical marijuana thing has worked in Missouri, it's not really, I mean, you know, we've got people advertising to go come see us and get a medical marijuana.
That shouldn't be a surprise. That's what started in California 20 years ago.
Right.
I mean, this was just a camel's nose in the tent.
Right.
But could that bring out voters that would be supportive of the Democrat? Who knows? You know, obviously, abortion's going to be an issue here, but I don't know that I see. Let's put the Senate side to the side because we don't know if there's going to be money invested here. Conventional wisdom would say it's going to go Republican. But Missouri and Illinois doesn't look like we're going to affect the congressional landscape at all. It looks like a status quo election.
Pretty much. The Democrats, I think, through gerrymandering, are going to pick up one seat in Illinois net. But, yeah, Missouri's not going to change. And now we have a situation where the one sort of competitive district we had was the second congressional district where Ann Wagner served. And that seat now is quite a bit more Republican than it was previously since redistricting. So, yeah, I don't know that you're going to see much partisan change in Missouri congressional districts for the next decade plus.
Yeah, things sure seem to be status quo. And, John, we also are going to be awaiting the court ruling or the president's release later today of the warrant that was issued for the investigation at Mar-a-Lago. I guess you might call it a raid.
Well, it was a search warrant.
Yeah, it was a search warrant. Some of the interesting developments I learned yesterday from Merrick Garland, just the amount of interaction they had leading up to this.
Mm-hmm.
That they had to get to a point where they pulled this. It's going to be some really compelling stuff for us to keep an eye on over the next couple of hours as this is going to roll out and we're all going to live it in real time together.
We are. And as we were just discussing before the news at the bottom of the hour, we still, even when the warrant is released, it may not contain enough information to tell us all that much. It may. I just don't know. But there's a lot of information remaining to be known here.
So much to talk about today. Cardinals return back to St. Louis. Boy, do they need to do it. We take on the Brewers, our interleague rival here in the Central.
This game's a battle for first place tonight. Cardinals are a half game up in the NL Central over the Brewers. Jordan Montgomery, the newly acquired left-hander, takes the hill. Let's hope he doesn't cramp up this time like he did his first time out for the Cardinals.
Yeah, well, he's going to get a little San Diego-style weather that we're experiencing right now. This does not feel like August in St. Louis. Boy, I wish it was like this all the time.
Albert Pujols comes to bat.
Cardinals slugger Albert Pujols talks with Tom Ackerman Mondays at 9:50.
He hits a fly ball left field, and it's gone!
Exclusively on the voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
Yeah, you know what that song is.
Whoa, ho. That's, is it not Cool in the Gang?
It is Cool in the Gang. 1982 Cardinals song. We're going to be celebrating 40 years this weekend of the Cardinals World Champion win.
40 years.
Bruce Sutter made that toss. I was at that game.
You were at? Wow, and you had to be a
I was pup. 7 years old.
Okay, yeah.
This was one of the benefits of being the only boy amongst five girls.
Uh-huh.
I went with my father, and for a bunch of the old labor folks that are listening and my family, the two names that I'm about to say will bring back some great memories. Bob Kortkamp and Andy Owens, my father and I, were at the ball game.
Nice.
I was a little dude.
Where'd you sit?
Upper deck somewhere. I don't remember that. What I do remember is when we won and all the people going on the field.
Yeah.
And as a little person, that scared me.
Yeah.
Because I thought something bad was happening. And then do you remember leaving the old Busch Stadium too? You'd have to walk across the catwalk that existed there on the, what is that, the west side of the
maybe
stadium?
Hundreds of times, yeah.
And it goes over to the garages.
Right.
That was the worst as a little person because, as, you know, you were like cows being herded into this very small, narrow throat.
Masses of humanity.
Yeah, and when you're a little guy, you know, your faces are with everybody's butts. You can't see anything. And, you know, I just remember every time we left the game, that was the part I hated the most was being in that crowd. And, you know, you're helpless as a little person. You can't see what's going on. You don't know where to go. You're holding on tight to your mom or dad. But such great memories of 1982.
Can you, how much of the starting starting eight for the Cardinals can you?
I could give it a shot, but I'm probably not going to be good at it.
At first
base, we had Keith Hernandez.
He was.
At second base, we had Tommy Hearn.
He was.
At third base, we had the Wizard.
No.
I mean, at shortstop, we had the Wizard.
Yes.
At third base, we had Kenny Obergefell.
That is also very accurate.
And left field, we had Lonnie Smith.
We did.
In center field, we had Willie McGee.
Very good.
And right field, we had Andy Van Slyke.
Not in 82.
Who was it?
Silent George Hendrick.
Did not know that.
And he had a big game seven. Hendrick did. RBI base hit behind the plate for the Cardinals.
It would have been Darryl Porter. And the reason I remember that is there was a commercial when I was a kid for Colonial Bread. Yeah. Is the MVP with minerals, vitamins, and protein.
Darryl Porter was the MVP of the
Missourian, right? He was
World
from Kansas
Series.
City?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be fun. They're celebrating that all day on the show today. They're going to be celebrating the 1982 World Series at the Cardinal game all weekend. It will be great to see a lot of those guys come back. I wonder how long Bruce Sutter's beard is now.
Yes, it's white, that much I know. And, yeah, it'll be good to see those guys. It is hard to believe it's 40 years. I was still, had just graduated from high school? Or no, I was in my first semester of college. I can't remember. It was a long time ago.
So today, John, in Washington, the United States House of Representatives will take up the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a green energy bill that was negotiated between Manchin and Schumer. All Democrats, including the Vice President of the United States, voted for it in the Senate. I can't imagine it will be much of a different outcome in the House.
No.
I think it's a great piece of legislation. It was compromise that came as a result of one of your heroes for the last couple of years, Joe Manchin. I can't imagine what your problem with it is.
Well, you know, the ironic thing is the stuff Manchin really wanted, the energy, you know, access to energy language that he wanted in there, the parliamentarian in the Senate struck because that provision couldn't go through the reconciliation process. So what Manchin negotiated isn't even in this final bill.
Interesting.
It is. And this bill is, in my opinion, a dog. I think it's going to be inflationary. It's going to result in tax increases for
the wealthiest.
Whole lot of them. You guys say that.
It's the truth.
Buddy, when you monkey with the tax code, as this thing does, I guarantee you that tax is going to be felt much further down the line than the people.
Those of us at the further down the line, whether it's a tax cut or a tax increase, feel it the worst of anybody because the tax increase never really trickles down to us. It always goes to that top 1%, and you all guard that top 1% like the Holy Grail. I don't get it because when I watch voters, they seem to be coming your way. Y'all are wrong on this, on not wanting to see wealthy people taxed properly.
If this thing generates, and I don't have the figures in front of me, but some ridiculous number they say that this revenue increase is going to generate. Well, you can't do that by just taxing wealthy people. You don't get that kind of money because by definition, there's only 1%. Of the top 1%, you know, and there's the money. If you want to raise revenues by taxing people, you've got to tax the middle class because that's where the numbers are. And the other concern I have about this bill is the expansion of the IRS capacity. Everybody thinks they're going to go after the rich folks and make sure they're paying their taxes. Here's the problem, and I think the dirty little secret with the IRS. When they go after a wealthy person, they're dealing with, at a minimum, an accountant or an accounting firm and an attorney. That's a difficult process. Where the IRS makes its money in going after tax cheats is people that don't have fancy accountants, and they go out, they file their taxes on TurboTax or whatever. And that's where my fear is this increased IRS activity is going to focus in on middle-class people.
It's simply that. It's nothing more than fear. This was the amount of jobs that have been gutted out of the IRS over the last several years. It's being put back in. And you're exactly right, John. When you're dealing with the wealthiest people who can afford the best accountants and the best lawyers, they're able to hide money, which means that you need IRS agents who are going to be able to look through that stuff with specialties. I think that's where this is going to go. We're not going to convince each other. We're going to watch it play out over the next couple of years. And hopefully I think the Democrats will prevail. My question to you next is about Ron DeSantis, clearly marching towards a run for president in 2024. He suspended a prosecutor, a countywide prosecutor in Florida, over the fact that prosecutor will refuse to enforce the abortion language that had been passed in the state of Florida.
Yes, and, you know, this is a really interesting precedent. Now, the prosecuting attorney there is engaged in litigation now and trying to figure out if the governor actually does have that authority Now, that's an open question. But one of the things that, and I, whether it's abortion or whatever, prosecutors that won't prosecute the law, they have prosecutorial discretion, like Mr. Smith here. Well, I'm not going to prosecute him for this particular crime for whatever reason. But Mr. Jones, I am going to prosecute for that crime. You have some prosecutorial discretion. What they don't have is the discretion to ignore a law. You know, they are bound by oath to uphold the law and to defend the law and to prosecute violators of the law. And that's a problem in Florida. I think it's a problem here in St. Louis.
I was going to say, if Ron DeSantis prevails in Florida, and that's a big if, this is going to be a long, drawn-out legal process that's going to play out. I mean, what's interesting to me is a lot of this stuff about Donald Trump that's hitting right now, everybody's saying, isn't it interesting it's hitting right now? No, this is, a lot of this has been in front of the courts for 2 and 3 years. This is just how long it's taken the process to work. So we're probably a year or two away from knowing what the ruling is in Florida. But if the cases, if they come out and say it is constitutional for him to do what he did, do you anticipate Republican governors, maybe potentially even Democratic governors around the state, to start to use that for some of this activism,
yeah,
prosecutors,
I mean,
which
at,
we're living with right here?
And you look at the prosecutor, Adams, I think his name is, in Manhattan. I mean, another prime, he won't prosecute snatch and grab crime, you know, theft. And you can't have prosecutors who won't comply with the law. I mean, that's law. That is the definition of lawlessness.
Well, let's just tackle it one more time, because hopefully we won't have to deal with it the rest of the day unless there's breaking news, which, of course, you want to keep your tune to KMOX. We'll keep you updated on all the changing stuff as it relates to the raid on Mar-a-Lago. But John Hancock, it sure seems to me, obviously I'm looking at this from a partisan lens, that Donald Trump may be in some of the biggest trouble he's experienced since he decided to dip his toe into politics.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, there's a number of different angles. He had that, that was just two days ago. He pled the fifth in the New York
400
state
times.
Case.
Only the mob takes the fifth.
That's a civil case against him. It's not a criminal case. And then you've got the Georgia investigation on the voting situation that the Atlanta prosecuting attorney has taken on, or it's the local DA in Atlanta, prosecuting a state statute on interference with elections. That case is moving on. The grand jury is there. And then, of course, you got the January 6th investigation, which we don't know if Donald Trump is involved in that from the Justice Department perspective. He may be, but we don't know that.
Yeah, and that's what's going to be interesting to see what it is. When it leaked last night that it was nuclear documents, I think it was a really big deal, hence the fact that we've seen nearly no response from any of the Republican leadership. We watched the conservative caucus, the Marjorie Taylor Greene folks, cancel their press conference today to rip on the Justice Department. And you and I said it live on the radio on Monday when this was breaking. It's just hard to believe that Merrick Garland would put it all on the line here if he didn't have the goods, because there's a numerous things that Democrats have been pressuring Merrick Garland to move forward with. But here it seems to me this is a guy who dots the I's and crosses the T's.
You would think, and we are most fortunate indeed today, this morning, we're going to have in studio with us next hour retired Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst, so much more than a military analyst, though. He served on the staff of the National Security Council. He's somebody that has firsthand experience in dealing with highly classified information, and that's going to be I'm really looking forward to that interview.
Going to be exciting to have him, and boy, wait till you hear his biography. We'll talk about an impressive man, and that's what it is. People who are doing the work of our government are some really special folks. And when you hear this man's pedigree, you will be blown away. You throw on top of that, we're going to be visiting with Tony Viviano.
Hey.
He's got a concert coming up. We haven't spoken to Tony in quite some
time.
It's
been a while. The Tennessee Williams Festival is coming up here in St. Louis, 7th annual. Tennessee Williams, considered by many to be the greatest American playwright of all time. He spent 20 formative years here in St. Louis. James O'Sullivan is behind the board today. Nothing better than having an O'Sullivan in the house. Michael Kelly, John Hancock, it's the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly. Sponsored by Insperity, HR that makes a difference. On News Radio 1120, KMOX.
All right. Let me hear you.
Be former KMOX alumni,
former
Cardinal broadcaster Harry Carey last night at the Field of Dreams. The Baby Bears beat the Cincinnati Reds 4-2. They had this interesting thing at the seventh inning stretch where it was a hologram of Harry Carey, who was singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and it was kind of strange.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
Really? You thought it was cool?
Yeah, I thought it was cool. All right. I mean, he was standing up there in the press box, you know? It was like the good old days. I had to think for a minute. Wait a minute. Didn't Harry Carey pass away like 15 years ago? But that's cool. That technology, I guess they've used it to put, you know, rappers on stage that have been deceased.
Yeah, well,
you know?
I went and saw a show out in Las Vegas that had Michael Jackson was a hologram in it the whole time, and there's real people dancing around him. So they were using that interesting technology. Yeah, you're right. I don't know. It just felt kind of a little weird, but I guess it was somewhat nostalgic.
Yeah, I thought it was cool.
Don't you think the Cardinals ought to be playing in Iowa and not you know,
well, that was a dog of a game. I mean, you're talking about the two worst teams in the National League Central, but, you know, Chicago is proximate to that cornfield. It's not easy to get to that corn. Have you ever been to the field?
I have been to the Field of Dreams, yes.
So how do you get there?
I don't remember. I was on the presidential campaign and we went there.
Oh, of course.
And it was about harvest time. So it was before they had knocked it down, but it was when the corn stalks were brown and yellow.
Yeah.
And those ugly Asian beetles were everywhere. Yeah. You know, they coat your car like dust. It was unbelievable.
Wow. And it's I don't know. I'm such a baseball nut and a nostalgia fan. Seeing that, you know, this corn just beyond the outfield walls, rows of it, you know, it was very, very cool. Did they announce the seating capacity last night?
Like 9,000, a little less than 9,000. The other thing that was kind of cute, that they did, it was obviously staged, was King Griffey and his father walked out of the corn, and they did a little cheesy thing like, hey, Dad, do you want to play catch? But then for a couple of minutes, you know, it was just King Griffey and King Griffey Jr. out in the middle of the center field throwing the ball back and forth just like something from the movie.
Do you remember Ken Griffey Sr. as a ball player?
So I remember the buzz around King Griffey Jr. when he was in Cincinnati and that he played a game with his dad.
In Seattle.
Was that in Seattle?
That was in Seattle.
Okay, so I do remember a little bit of that, but not much.
Well, that was at the very end of Ken Griffey Sr.'s career. Good ball player.
Right.
Not his son, but, I mean, good ball player. Very speedy, and he was on those great Cincinnati teams in the 1970s that won a couple of World Series titles, a big red machine. He was part of that, center fielder out there. And then went and spent his final years in Seattle when his son came up, and they played together in the outfield for one season.
Huh.
And there was at least one game where they both homered.
Wow.
And that was a pretty cool deal.
Yeah, driving downtown St. Louis, you know, we have a lot sometimes to point out the zits of St. Louis, if you will. Whether
you and I
trash
have been zit pointers of St. Louis par excellence.
But boy, oh boy, I'll tell you what, just driving from the Central West End to downtown, there must be 9 cranes that are up around the BJC complex and
the
Cortex complex.
There are always cranes at the BJC complex.
Yeah, and then you think about the cranes that are up in Clayton. You know, whenever I go to another city, I'm always amazed with the amount of cranes you see and think, boy, couldn't we have that going on? And we do. There is quite a bit of cranes out there. It's good to see all this construction and work that's taking place. It makes you feel like St. Louis is moving in the right direction.
You know, we've often talked about this plethora of new apartment buildings that are being built all over the place.
Right.
And wondering to ourselves, who in the heck is living in these things? But we had lunch this week with the head of the St. Louis Association of Realtors.
And he told us that those things fill out. I mean, there is demand for that housing.
There's a huge housing need in the St. Louis area, particularly affordable housing, which was a surprise to me because, you know, again, they built that brand new, 40-story high-rise in the Central West End. And
that's the thing that looks like an avocado, right?
Right, or an onion or whatever you might see, a cheese grater.
Uh-huh,
yeah. But it kind of... when I saw the rents on it, I'm like, who's going to move into this? And I read the other day they're in 100% capacity. So there must be three brand new apartment complexes going up around me right now. And we learned this week from the realtors that, boy, we need them, and they will be filled up in no time.
Yeah, which I guess, even because I don't feel like we're attracting a lot of new people here.
No.
But something's happening if all this housing stock is being taken up. And now, there's a lot of vacant housing stock throughout St. Louis City and in parts of North St. Louis County.
Right.
And that, you know, we've talked about for years needing to do something about all this vacant property. And, you know, I haven't seen much progress.
Yeah, one of the things that I've never understood, and look, I'm not an urban planner, so I don't understand this kind of stuff.
Well, I can explain it to you.
But when they say, hey, we've got to go and rebuild the complete north side, and we've had different projects that have popped up, it just seems to me that can't we do some stuff on the edges of things that are working? So downtown is working, and we're starting to see it, you know, expand a little bit north of the dome there with Square, et cetera, going in. The Central West End is working. We're now starting to see that push further north. Then you have the Del Mar Divine, which just came on north of the park there. So hopefully this push will continue to happen and bring back some life into parts of the city that need it, and probably some of our more glorious moments as a city took place in places right now that are abandoned.
Yeah, it's true. And not to mention the NGA facility, which is really has the potential to revolutionize the north side.
So we are going to go take a break here in a couple of minutes, but we're going to visit with our good old friend Tony Viviano.
He's singing.
I always like when Tony comes in because he sings a little Tony Bennett with us. You know what I'm saying, baby?
Well, he's going to be singing some Italian coming up in a week or so, and we're going to visit with a couple of people from the Tennessee Williams Festival. It's the 7th annual Tennessee Williams Festival. This year's theme, Tennessee Williams and Italy, hence Tony Viviano's appearance, and he's going to be doing some singing at that. We're also going to visit with the director and the producer and assistant director of the Tennessee Williams Festival. That thing is all throughout Grand Center. It's going to be massive, and it's going to be great. I encourage all of you to check that out later this hour. Retired Colonel Jeff McCausland from the U.S. Army is going to join us. He was also a staff member on the National Security Council in the 1990s. He knows about confidential records, top secret documents. He's going to tell us about that. Might get into what's happening in Ukraine as well. He'll be with us live in studio, and all of that and more coming your way. It's Hancock and Kelly on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Now, back to Hancock and Kelly, sponsored by Insperity, HR that makes a difference, on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
And welcome back. to Hancock and Kelly. It's a Friday morning. That's why we're here. And Tony Viviano's in studio. Bring us a little something, Tony. Well, that's a lot of law. You got to love that. Tony Viviano's in studio with us. It is the 7th annual Tennessee Williams Festival coming up in St. Louis, August the 18th through the 28th. And it's going to be all over Grand Center. So much to do and see. The theme of this year's is Tennessee Williams, Italy. And that's hence Tony Viviano's presence. And joining us on the line from New York is the director of The Rose Tattoo, a great Tennessee Williams play that's going to be performed. David Kaplan joins us. David, welcome to KMOX.
Thank you. Good morning.
How are the rehearsals coming along?
The rehearsals are going very well. It's very exciting. And Tony's presence makes it that much more exciting. There was an idea about including Italian music that was sung, and he is more than fulfilling that.
Wonderful. And the Rose Tattoo. You know, a lot of people consider Tennessee Williams to be America's greatest playwright. Do you concur?
Yep. Yes, I do. I do. For the breadth of his work and for the American nature of his work, that he didn't just write plays set in the South. He wrote plays that were set all over the world, and particularly had a love for Italy.
Going to be included in the Tennessee Williams Festival. Tell us a little bit about what's going to happen, where people can get some information on participating in this as well.
The main production is The Rose Tattoo. It opens on the 18th of August and runs those two weekends. Their tickets are available at metrotix.org. And information about the subsidiary events and the satellite events, which are on the Hill, is at TWS TL, Tennessee Williams, St. Louis, TWSTL.org.
Awesome.
And that explains the other events.
And you, Tony Viviano, you've been pulled into this. How excited are you to be able to perform Tennessee Williams in the language that you sing so well?
I just can't. To me and said, "You're the guy we want." I said, "Wow." So I'm glad to be here with everybody. All the actors are great.
And you're singing in Italian, right?
I'm singing in Italian. It's not just like That's Amore and Volare. These are the actual Italian songs that David picked out, and they are just phenomenal.
And David, tell us a little bit about The Rose Tattoo. It's, you know, I think of Tennessee Williams. Of course, I think of Streetcar Named Desire, a lot of other. But The Rose Tattoo is one I've not seen.
I wanted to talk a little bit first, and it'll relate to that, about what Tony brings to the production.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Why I asked him to sing in Italian. The Rose Tattoo is set among a community of Italian immigrants from Sicily on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. And it was my idea that the records that they brought with them from the old country were sung in Italian. And it was a continuity in Mississippi with their culture. And so I researched what they would have listened to. The play is set in the late 1940s, early 50s. And I researched what they would have listened to, what records they would have brought from the 20s or 30s. And that would be treasured connections to them of their heritage. And so that is what Tony is singing. And also what they would be listening to hear them, that it wouldn't be on the radio. It would be stick LPs, and it would be a phonograph with a horn. And also that they were in their memory that these songs were associated with life and death and lovemaking or getting married or the first date. And so the play, which is about a celebration of life, the shortest version of it is that a woman has a miscarriage and then her husband dies on the same day and she falls into a deep depression and secludes herself for 3 years. And then as a sort of miracle, a new love appears in her life and she's pregnant again. And so it's a very hopeful play about rebirth as a result of adversity. And I think it's unusual in the collection of plays we associate with Williams for being so joyous and for having a happy ending. There are other plays that have a happy ending by Williams, but none with so happy an ending, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's going to be a spectacular performance. How many folks are in the cast?
Oh, my. I think maybe 20 when all is said and done. And the other thing that I wanted to say is that Williams was really inspired by his experience of the Italian community on the Hill. When he lived in St. Louis, he clearly went there. And he clearly had an understanding of what went on there, and that it was different from his own family life and from the rest of St. Louis. And I think that's an important connection between Williams and the Hill.
David Kaplan is our guest. He's the director of The Rose Tattoo, a Tennessee Williams play. Tony Viviano in studio. He'll be singing in Italian during that play. That's going to be very cool. Williams was born in Mississippi, 1911.
Yeah.
So does this play reflect some of his personal experiences, or is it something just from the fruitful brain of his?
No, this is not so much an autobiographical play in that it's set in a community he didn't live in. Of course, any artist makes images out of his own life, and particularly a theater writer. You know, the art of theater is the art of human relations, and so a playwright is creating out of the human relations that he experiences or observes. And so, no, this is not an aspect of his life. This is his, as he said, a kind of dream play.
And there's so many other panels going on at this thing. We've got Italian Americans in the Hill of Tennessee Williams. That's going to take place. There's going to be a panel.
There's a walking tour of the Hill,
which is really cool. I've done that myself before. That's there's so much history there, and it's such a cool tour. So that's going to be something. This festival, it draws people from all across, well, all over the world, this Tennessee Williams Festival.
I'm very happy to be part of St. Louis's celebration of Williams. And I think Williams is associated with New Orleans. Williams is associated with Provincetown. Williams is associated with Key West. Williams is associated with Hollywood. And he spent a very significant portion of his life here, his adolescence, his later childhood, his college years. And it really formed his ways of thinking. And perhaps for that reason, he didn't talk too much about it.
And he also lived in St. Louis for like 22 years on Locust Street.
Yep. Graduate of Washington University here in St. Louis. Well, this festival, it's its seventh year. It's getting bigger every year. You can get information at twstl.org. Tickets are available. The play is The Rose Tattoo. I want to thank Mr. Kaplan, for David Kaplan, for being with us. And Tony Viviano, where else are you singing these days?
I'm going to be on the Hill singing at Guido's.
Nice.
Songs from the play. And that's going to be on the panel there. That's going to be on August 21st. But I would like to personally invite my friends and my following and my family to come to this play. It is wonderful.
Tony Viviano on stage in the Tennessee Williams play. It doesn't get any better than that. Hey, we got to step aside. Colonel Jeff McCausland is next on KMOX.
KMOX is Cardinals Radio.
It's the Cards and Brewers tonight. Emron pregame show 6:20. First pitch 7:15. Hear the game on KMOX and streaming on KMOX.com.
We're lucky people, Hancock. Sometimes we get to meet with legends, and today is one of those.
Well, Colonel Jeff McCausland, we've talked to him on the phone many, many a time. He is the CBS military analyst, retired Colonel Jeff McCausland, but so much more than that. He was the dean of academics at the U.S. War College. He was a battalion commander during the Gulf War, 1990 and 91. He was on the staff of the National Security Council, and he's the author of battle-tested Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders, a book I have read and thoroughly enjoyed. He's also a graduate of West Point and holds a Ph.D. from Tufts University. How's that for a resume?
Wow.
Colonel McCausland, welcome to St. Louis.
Great to meet you guys. Just proves you're old, you know.
What brings you to St. Louis?
Well, I'm coming to town. I have a lot of relatives in the area. I have a brother and his family live here in St. Louis. I have another brother who lives right across the river over in Illinois. And so we try to get together. My oldest brother's coming down from Wisconsin. So we periodically, the four, try to get together and have a guy's weekend. And so we're doing that. And of course, good old KMOX graciously has allowed us to be their guest at the ball game tonight. So we'll go out. And I got to say, because I think you all know this, I am. Yeah. I will admit publicly, I am a Chicago Cubs fan.
It's right? Nobody can be perfect.
How can somebody so great be such a loser?
But I am going to root very hard for the Cardinals tonight because I really dislike the Brewers.
Yeah,
so I will root for the Cardinals tonight.
That's a game that's a first-place battle tonight,
it
too.
It is a huge battle tonight.
It's a big game. Well, so glad to have you, especially given the recent events in the news. And you're the guy to help. So you were on the staff of the National Security Council. You understand, you know, top secret documents and different levels of clearances. And we don't know what the Justice Department, the FBI, was looking for, but what kinds of documents would fall into this category?
Well, it just seems to me, and I know absolutely nothing about the raid. I know absolutely nothing, like any American, about what exactly they seized in the course of that raid. But it would seem to me, at least, the things that would be most concerning would be anything having to do with so-called sources and methods of intelligence. That would lead you towards human intelligence agents we have overseas that might be compromised, or people in foreign governments that are actually supporting the United States. So anything that might compromise them actually might put them in personal danger. And the methods we use for gathering intelligence, those would be causes of great concern from a national security standpoint. Secondly, and there has been some suggestion of that in the press, whether it's true or not, again, don't know, is any documents having to do with nuclear weapons, which could be the position of nuclear weapons, technology involving nuclear weapons and the like, that obviously would be very, very detrimental to U.S. national security. But it would certainly seem to me that this type of an exercise operation would only be for something that was really of grave national security concern.
So there are levels of classification.
Absolutely.
And so you go from confidential to secret to top secret, and then even within top secret there are levels, right?
Absolutely.
Explain that.
Well, yeah, secret. You got confidential, secret, and top secret. Then you have documents that are called no foreign. In other words, they are no foreign distribution whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have compartmentalized information, which means information that has to do specifically with technology would be compartmentalized. And just if you've got a top secret clearance, doesn't mean you can wander in and have access to any top secret document. You have to have cause or reason based on the position you're holding to have access to those documents. So when I was on the NSC staff, and I had the highest level of security clearance that you can get, that still only gave me access to those documents that were appropriate to what I was working on. I was working on European issues, so I couldn't wander down the hall and walk in the Africa office and, you know, gather up classified documents having to do with Africa or the Middle East or something else.
There was reporting in, I believe, the New York Times this morning that some of the documents they were looking for were SAPs, special access programs. Right. What are those?
Special access programs would be, again, compartmentalized information. And again, you have the clearance for this, and then you have to have granted special access to that particular program because you are involved in it. You could have the requisite clearance, but you wouldn't have access because you have not been part of that special access system.
I understand that while you're the president of the United States, much of that documents would be brought in front of you. Somebody like you would be reading and briefing the president on it.
Yep.
How would they have ever have been left there to all the way through the day that the president departs to be able to pack up and take with them?
A great question, but over the course of the 4 years, of course, the president, to some degree, can exercise how his office is run operationally and administratively. And we do know that because they've been turned over, that Mr. Trump took 15 boxes of classified information back to Mar-a-Lago because those have already been retrieved prior to this particular incident. So for whatever reason, he and the people working immediately around him determined that they wanted to maintain that in some type of immediate access storage facilities. So when he departed the White House, he could take it with him.
Seems to me that classified and secret information is the lifeblood of what you all do in the national security group there. This type of discussion, regardless of the fact that it's from Donald Trump, it can't be good for what you all want. This is not something you want to be talking about and having to explain.
No, and the other part of the problem, this and this began with Mr. Trump, quite frankly, at the very onset of his administration. I think people forget this. And that very early in his administration, he invited then Foreign Minister Lavrov of the Russian Federation and the Ambassador Kislyak from Russia into the Oval Office. And in the course of that, there was widespread reporting that he was bragging about really what we would call access and methods.
Related to Israeli intelligence.
Yeah, and compromised, some believe, at least one Israeli agent in the process. Well, the problem, that then has a ripple effect. All your allies who you cooperate with, we've got a cooperative program with the British and others called the Multiple Eyes or Five Eyes program, where we share intelligence with our allies. Well, when you have something like that happen, your allies suddenly go, maybe we're not going to share with you because there's a problem in your organization that may compromise our sources and methods, and we don't want that to happen. So it has that secondary effect.
Literally, people's lives are on the line.
Literally, people's lives are on the line.
Yeah, and you know, to the question of how he would have access to these, my understanding at least is that top secret documents are included in the president's daily briefing book that he received.
Yes.
So it could be, we're speculating, but it could be that it's briefing books that they're picking
Very
up.
Well could be. Mm-hmm. Very well could be.
Well, this is fascinating, and it looks like the warrant is going to be released. I don't know if it will be released today, but looks like it's going to be released. And wow. Let's turn our attention now. I'm very interested in what's happening in Ukraine. And I know you've spent a lot of time in Europe in understanding European and foreign relations there and what's happening. It looks like the Russians have made a pretty good penetration into the Donbas region and not much more. Is that accurate?
That's very accurate. I mean, from the beginning, they actually, I think, had the intent to take the country, because if you look at the onset, they had a five-pronged offensive focused on the capital, focused on Kharkiv, the second largest city, focused on the Donbass, and focused on coming up from the south on Crimea. Very quickly, they realized that wasn't going to work, and they got stopped. And then they concentrated their efforts, as you mentioned there, John, in the Donbass region, comprising two provinces, Luhansk and Donetsk. For the last about months, they have been able to secure the Luhansk province, but only a portion of Donetsk. And their offensive there is kind of ground to a halt. Consequently, we see the Ukrainians now trying to mount a counteroffensive, particularly in the south towards Crimea, around a city called Kherson, which was captured by the Russians in March. And because of their ability to do that, the Russians now have had to reposition forces from the south and east to the south, and this also has put more pressure on Russian supply lines from Russia proper out to Crimea. And that really seems to be causing them an awful lot of difficulty. Furthermore, the Pentagon even said this week, and their numbers I found are normally pretty conservative, but they've publicly said through a spokesman that the Russians may have suffered as many as 80,000 casualties in the last 6 months. Now, casualties, that's killed, wounded, missing, captured, whatever. Well, my goodness, that's one half of their entire initial attack force at the onset. That's about one quarter of the entire active Russian army.
Yes.
So they're really suffering manpower.
That's great. That's the case, and boy, we hope it is. As somebody who's studied war their entire life and what's going on here from a distance, what kind of grade do you give the Ukrainians here? And is it extra compelling that we're now seeing them fight off of their own soil and with this bombing that took place in Crimea?
Yeah, if you want to give them a grade, I'd give them about a B minus. And the reason I'd give them a B minus is because I think they could have been better prepared. And there'll be some discussion when this is all over why we weren't better prepared. Don't forget, back in February, we were telling them they're going to invade, and the Ukrainians kept saying, no, they're not. So there is that part of the problem. But certainly since then, the Ukrainians have acquitted themselves far better than we ever imagined, and the Russians have been abysmal. I'd give the Russians about a D or a D minus in terms of their military performance. And it seems to me to kind of, you know, back to setting war, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte, some almost two centuries ago, once said the moral is to the physical as three is to one. And I think we're seeing that played out once again, that the Ukrainians, who believe they're fighting for their country and fighting for how they want to live, are far more, you know, superior, far more aggressive than the Russians are, who are just getting ground up.
What the Crimea bombing, you believe that was probably done by the Ukrainians?
Oh, yeah.
And this was that a big sign that they're taking this off their own soil?
Huge. That was a huge sign. There's the Sakhy Air Base, which was about 200 miles from the closest Ukrainian position. So they're buried to strike at that depth. And it's unclear to this point how they did that. Did they use some of their anti-ship missiles? Because the weapons we've given don't have the range. Were they able to penetrate with aircraft? Some even believe it may have been a special operations mission, also augmented by Ukrainian partisans who are also operating now behind Russian lines.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is with us in studio. He's going to stick around till the top of the hour, and we need to step aside right now. We'll be back after this on KMOX.
Local news and information direct to your smart speaker. Just say, play KMOX.
It's Hancock and Kelly. We are joined in studio by the legend, just one of the most impressive people you'll ever meet, Colonel Jeff McCausland.
He really is.
You hear him right here.
I've been called a lot of things, but not a legend.
Well, you are, and he'll be at the Cardinal game tonight rooting for the Cardinals, even though he's a Cub fan. We're grateful to have you, Colonel, in St. Louis, and thank you for your contribution always to KMOX.
Great pleasure to be here with you guys today and really join you. And you guys do a great stuff here in this wonderful city of St. Louis, which is kind of my second hometown in many ways.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. And, you know, in the midst of this Russian conflict, we hear NATO a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We also heard NATO a lot during the Trump administration. President Trump wanted to dismantle it. He wanted to end it. How close were we to NATO falling apart? And how important is NATO in the process right now in our aid to Ukraine?
Well, answer the second question first. It's essential. And Mr. Putin, I think, made an error at the onset, several errors. But one was the assumption that the West wouldn't get their act together when he invaded Ukraine. And what he has seen is that the NATO has come together and has coordinated a real substantial effort in providing military assistance to the Ukrainians. And that's really a credit, I think, in many ways to the Biden administration. Whether you like the Biden administration or not, that one thing that they got right. NATO is pretty much close to going off the rails, or at least becoming irrelevant. Mr. Trump had said on several occasions he was unsure whether we would stand behind our Article 5 commitments to come to the aid of a country, a member, if they were attacked. He said that on many occasions, kind of, if you will, dampening down their belief that we actually had credible support to them. Number two is he had spoken many times about pulling the United States out of NATO, and his former national security advisor, I think John Bolton and others, have said they were convinced that if, in fact, he had been reelected, he would have pulled the United States out of NATO. And in that case, I think the Russians would have been successful.
This flawed thought process has seemed to have infected our junior senator. He was the only United States senator to vote against Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Any thoughts on that?
I found it pretty doggone surprising. I mean, he alone, I mean, Rand Paul, you have to give credit where credit's due. Rand Paul voted present. He didn't vote yes or no. But Mr. Hawley was the only person to vote against that. And if you look at the current situation, number one, that we need to halt Russian offensives in Europe, number one, I think we would all agree on that. And that this is a matter of really living in a world that is ruled by norms and acceptable international system and supporting democracies and the kind of values we treasure, this would seem to be kind of a no-brainer. And Sweden and Finland certainly are democracies, market economies largely, and are serious military contributors. They have significant military power. So I find it particularly curious at that moment Mr. Hawley would vote against their admission, particularly since he had voted against the last country to join NATO. He had voted in favor of them, and that was Northern Macedonia. Now, I don't know a great deal about Northern Macedonia, but I'm confident of one thing. Their military contribution to NATO is minuscule as compared to either Finland or Sweden. So I would really like to ask Mr. Hawley to explain those two votes. One in favor of Northern Macedonia, but opposed to Finland and Sweden.
The one thing we know about Northern Macedonia is it is north of Southern Macedonia. We do know that. I want to, in the little bit of time we have remaining, China, military exercises around Taiwan, probably has taken a lesson or two from the Soviet invasion of Ukraine, or the Russian invasion of Ukraine. How imminent is the threat of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, in your opinion?
I do not think it is imminent. Xi Jinping and the Chinese have talked about this as something that needs to be accomplished by 2049. Why 2049? 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. They've always said they wanted to see this reunification occur peacefully. That has been a stated policy of China. But they've never taken the military option off the table. People in the Pentagon, the current national security strategy, have said they see no imminent thought that the Chinese are willing to do that. They have obviously tried to intimidate Taiwan. I think that's backfiring. Opposition to becoming part of China higher than ever in Taiwan. And there is a concern that they might think about doing something in the time period like 2023, 2024. Why? Because we'd be in the midst of a presidential election campaign, and so would Taiwan. And so there is some concern that those that window of time might be a period of greater concern.
Yeah, it's that's something. And the U.S. policy toward Taiwan, I don't think a lot of people understand the one China policy we have. What, how does that work? Because it's tricky.
It is very tricky. In 1979, we announced the one China policy in which we recognized the People's Republic of China as the legitimate government of the mainland. And there would be one China. And we ceased our formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Now, we still have trading offices and diplomatic offices there, but not a formal embassy. At the same time, we adopted a strategy of so-called strategic ambiguity, and that being that we would not articulate clearly how we would respond if, in fact, the Chinese were to invade Taiwan. Now, Mr. Biden has been very outspoken during this recent crisis that the United States would come to the defense of Taiwan. Some of his people around him have tried to kind of walk that one back, but we've stuck with that strategic ambiguity as part of our strategy. Whether we can continue to do that or not in future, I think, is problematical. And one thing I think that's worth pointing out is Taiwan now is the world's largest exporter of highly sophisticated microchips, which are critical to the world economy. So they have become critically important in all those supply chains, raising another reason, along with being a democracy, why we might consider defending them.
So apparently, Colonel McCausland, you have come bearing gifts.
I have come bearing gifts. One in sort of... And thanking you guys for the great things you do and for the many kindnesses you've shown me. When I retired from the Army, we had a custom in the Army to give people a coin if they did, you know, great service. And so when I created my company, Diamond Six, I decided to have a coin. So I want to give each one of you guys one of my coins.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wait a minute. On one side is our logo, Diamond Six, which was my radio call sign during the Gulf War. That's where Diamond Six came from. And on the other side is a phrase I like, consists with my book, Battle Tested, learn from the past to prepare for the future. So I got one for each one of you guys. Now, there's one condition.
Oh, okay.
Here's the condition. In the custom, when I come back, if you don't have this damn coin on you,
right,
you have to buy the drinks.
Understood.
Well,
I accept the challenge.
Michael buys the drinks anyway. That's why I love
Colonel,
him so much.
This is such an honor to have you in studio.
Great.
I hope the next time you come to St. Louis, you'll do it again because, well, we didn't have enough time
there
today.
There never is enough time.
Yeah. We didn't get to talk about that nuclear power plant. We didn't get to talk about so many of the issues that are facing our world. An exciting time, and we're grateful that you're always contributing to KMOX.
It's great to be with you guys.
Real quick on your book. Battle Tested, Gettysburg Leadership Lessons for 21st Century Leaders. That is a phenomenal
book. You're too kind.
And Gettysburg is one of my favorite eras of all American
history. Will you guys come out, and I will take you on a personal tour on the battlefield.
There he is.
I'm in.
Colonel McCausland, that's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. We'll be back with the show here in a little bit. We'll see Dave Glover. Stick around.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Bye.